Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
Song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it. It has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. And we will be able to rise from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. And this will be a great America. We will... There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we join together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism.
Dr. King movement on this Monday night, and we're talking about the flood all the way from Minnesota down on Mississippi, and the flood right now as I speak tonight, the flood is coming down from Minnesota, and they got floods in Minnesota La Crosse, Wisconsin, the Mississippi River is overflowing on some of the roads. We prophesied that last month. I want to get ready tonight from 9 to 10. We're going to hear from Dr. Martin Luther King. One of the issues right now is the evil spirit that is blanking out the community with shootings, murder, killing, and it seems like nobody care enough what to do. And what I'm saying, as we get ready to go into the summer months, God needs to talk to you. And God needs to talk to you personally. Now, God talked to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God can talk to you. And right now, as we get ready to talk about civil rights, human rights, over in Sudan, they're in a war, fighting for power, two black men fighting for power. In Ukraine, two white men fighting for power. Over in Israel, they got wars in Israel. So the Bible said rumors of war. And we got war. We got war in the Middle East, war in Ukraine, Russia, and Ukraine, along with America, is involved. You know, if I give you a stick to hit somebody, I'm just involved as the one to hit you. China is involved over in Africa, so they fight now the power. They put all the white folks out of Africa. And right now, they got helicopters picking all up, but you got some private contractors, teachers, doctors, lawyers, that left America to go and work in Africa. They find themselves can't get back home. Some of them got dual citizenship, like over in Israel. All those people in Israel got American ship, and they got dual citizenship. They got citizenship for America and for Israel. And some people, white in Africa, got dual citizenship. What does that mean? That means that you're still in America. You're getting all the goods from Africa or from Haiti, and you're bringing them back to America. But you have never said that you were a full-blood American or you were a full-blood African. Tonight, we're talking about Dr. King and the next level. Dr. King talked about Mississippi, Arkansas. We're getting ready before I tell you this, that we're going to have floods back to back. Now, I told you floods are going to hit Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, and to the Gulf. It's going to hit some parts of Atlanta and some parts of Alabama and Ohio. This word that coming forward, that's going to happen, so you get ready. I'm going to play a little Dr. Clark, and we're going to bring Dr. King back. But from, let me see this here. From 9 to 10 is Dr. Martin Luther King movement. And from 11 to 12, God going to talk to you. Let me say it again. I ain't going to talk. God's going to talk. So you got to be tuning in to listen to what God's going to say. When God, if five people in the room, God's going to talk to all them five people a different way. What I mean, if God talking to me tonight, you know what he's saying to me. If God talking to you tonight, I don't know what God's saying to you. You got to interpret what God is saying to you so you'll know how to conduct yourself, okay? Once you understand how God talks to you, you can adjust yourself in a certain way, or you know God is talking to you. God still cares for you. We're talking about the mass murders that's going on before your eyes. over the weekend, they had shooting in every state. They got one man shot a boy, knocked on his door. A lady pulled in the driveway, they shot her. Another lady, man was in the paint, shot him. So we had about 20 shootings of citizens shooting citizens because they got guns. They ain't said nothing about banning assault weapons until the Democrats and Republicans get on the same page. They sunk $1 trillion over to Ukraine and guns and stuff. They sunk $1 trillion over to Israel. Now, the young man that they arrested for a legal document, he had documents showing where this money done went, taxpayer money. And he's showing where people are purchasing guns. It's more guns in America than people. Let me break it down. Biggest New York is, you got more people got guns than the police. In Chicago, you got more people got guns than police right now. So the police is outgunned. Okay. So what we're getting ready to bring the Democratic Convention here, it's got to be some money and jobs for the people. This is March Saturday. You said they marching downtown. They should have been marching in the neighborhood where people getting shot, their house being robbed, they getting jacked. There ain't nothing downtown. It's in the neighborhoods. It's in Inglewood, Lumdale, Roseland, High Park. It's in the neighborhood. They should pull themselves together. But too little, too late, like they always do. So my thing is, tonight, sit back and listen to what Dr. King gonna say and write down some notes. Maybe you need to go look it up yourself. What I'm saying to you tonight, there's a drastic change that's happening from the White House to the State House to the outhouse. So if we don't change, we will destroy our youth coming up. I ain't talking about them that going downtown trying to snatch and grab. They're going to prison. They're getting ready to go to prison. They don't want to mind the teacher. The teacher ain't trying to teach them. Because you know, Pookie and Dookie on their way to prison. They're robbing, stealing, and killing. This is kind of image that they put out there. I want to say to you tonight, if we don't get a hold on this gun and the assault rifles, and the government got to come up with a creative plan to get these guns, these assault rifles, get them out of the neighborhood, out of Mississippi, Chicago, New York, Birmingham, Alabama, so they got to get that out. Once they can take control. Now, I want to say this, Brother Jerry, that I want to say this, Brother Lena. Reason people are shooting people, they are possessed. Let me say it again. They are possessed by demonic spirits. And that demonic spirit tells them to kill somebody and kill yourself. Because those are demonic spirits that's happening. So that's what them demonic spirits is doing. Okay? So that's what happened. So as we get ready to go to the next level, I want you to be able to listen to a little of Dr. Clark. Dr. Clark is an African historian. He have wrote many books. He has been all over the world, and he landed right in Africa. And we're going to play a little hymn.
Ah. my main point here is that none of us should get into this dialogue of my slave master is better than your slave master, inasmuch as all of them were bad. But each one of us had to deal with a given situation. And all of the situations were bad. And all of the situations were humiliating. And none of the slave masters were kind. And none of them did us any favor. And none of them favored one over the other. And understand that the slave ships did not bring any black Americans or any Caribbean out of Africa. They were only African people, and all of them had to become what the system made them become. And so we have to understand that all of us belong to a collective African family away from home. And subsequently, we are going to have to go back home or make some kind of contribution to Africans in Africa. All right, that's not my point. That's not the subject for tonight, but it is a subject that we cannot avoid. All right, now, why the emphasis on Africa and the rise of Christianity? And I'll tell you how I came to the subject briefly. Because I learned to read very early, because I wanted to teach Sunday school in a Baptist church, and because I had I was under the persuasion of a great lady, my great-grandmother, one of the great loves of my existence, because she was devoutly religious and a believer in the Bible to the point of saying everything in the Bible is true and not to be contradicted. When I found all those white images and went to Grandma, Grandma said, "Shut up, boy. That's God's word." When I mentioned the curse and asked the question, what did we do as a people to get cursed? She rationalized it and said that, well, one day the veil will be lifted and will be freed of the curse. I could not deal with this because I had so much faith in her and her deep religious belief that everything in the Bible was true. I had not grown up, of course. I had not read books about how the Bible got written. I did not know at that time how to separate history from Jewish folklore. I did not know that principally the Bible is a Jewish survival book and a very good one, and that some of it is pure history, some of it is pure folklore, but all of it is spirituality. And we must understand, all of it was told as a spiritual story and for the spiritual enhancement of all men. I had not at that time looked at the Egyptian version and the Ethiopian version of the Bible. It was not until the late 30s that I saw an Ethiopian Bible. And in the Ethiopian Bible, there was only one white character, and that was the devil. I had not at that time been exposed to all of that are the literature concerning the religions of the world. I saw that Africa was the basis of all the three major world religions. What I want to look at, I want to look at not only Africa as the basis of the world's religions, I want to look at the spirituality of the world of that day before the formal development of these religions. Because these religions were developed out of the spirituality that existed at the time. And that the spirituality at the time and the religions at the time was not a weekend thing. It was an all-conclusive thing that it embraced the life of its inheritance. To such an extent, your religion determined your dress, your marriage, your diet, it determined where you lived, it determined the totality of your life. And it was not a partial thing in your life, it was a total thing in your life as your choice of spirituality supposed to be. Western man made it something that it was never intended to be. Now, my main point is that all of the elements that went into the making of the world's three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of the elements existed in Africa 3,000 years before the formal development of these religions. We want to look at these elements and look at these stories. Then we want to deal with the Hebrew interest and to what extent they copied African folklore and made this folklore a part of their history. And the same folklore having existed in Africa for thousands of years before they arrived. Now, what you have to look at also is the fact that we are talking about a period in the history of the world when there was no such thing as Europe. It's hard for you to believe this, and it is hard for you to understand that for most of the existence of the world, for most of the time, man has been functioning in the world, there was no such place as Europe. Now, we're looking at civilizations that existed before the creation of a place in northern Asia called Europe. That is not a continent. What you have to understand is the impact of the glacial age. And the glacial age hit Europe. For most of the existence of these early civilizations, Europe was an ice cap and was uninhabited. It was only after the melting of this ice that people could go into Europe and form a civilization or a way of life. And these first people were Africans. Now, you're wondering, how did they become white? Well, it's a longer story that we can tell. But nature endows man and woman with the covering they need where nature put them down. And nature subtracts from man and woman things that they do not need in the climate and in the environment where nature put them down or where they choose to dwell. All right, now, Christianity developed out of African humanistic values and social thought. These humanistic values and social thought was old in Africa and remained in Africa for thousands of years before someone gave the religion a name. In other words, that was probably more Christianity before someone decided that it should have a name and they put a name on it. Now this is reflected in a lot of literature, some written by our own writers, John Jackson's Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, where he traces the concept of Christ in 26 civilizations, all 1,000 miles apart. In another work, Man, God, and Civilization, and another pamphlet, The African Origins of Christianity, and his new work, only out a few months ago, Christianity Before Christ. Now the unfortunate thing about a book like Christianity Before Christ is that a lot of people will read the title, be intrigued with the title, and little afraid to read the book. And yet he has treated the subject with great delicacy and with great respect. All he has done is to point out that all of the elements that ultimately went into the making of Christianity existed in Africa before Christ, and someone came along and a set of circumstances made man formalize those elements and give it a name. Now that is not disrespectful of the religion at all. It is a tracing of the origins of the religion to African sources, Nile Valley sources, mainly Ethiopia and the nations in the Nile Valley. We're not emphasizing Egypt alone, because Egypt alone was not the producers of this great civilization. A complex of nations in the Nile Valley produced this civilization and produced the religion, the concept of worship, and the concept of a single God first appeared in Ethiopia. But the formalization of the concept would later appear in Egypt during the period of Akhenaten. All right, now, my point is that in looking at the religion, we have to look at the history at the same time. And we have to look at some of the literature around it, especially John Jackson's work, Ethiopia and the Origins of Civilization, and the Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, and other works, including the later work on the African origins of Christianity. All right. He shows also how this religion spread to India, spread to other parts of the world, and took on different names, and these deities appeared under other guises. All right, now, the formalization of these religions of this religion and this religion functioning side by side with other religions brought no conflict at this time in history, none of the conflict that we see today. And we see it first taking shape in Ethiopia and moving down the Nile. In the fortunate circumstance of its birth and its development before someone gave it a name, because there was no pressure or agitation about it in this setting. There was no Asian, there was no European, and the Africans wasn't fighting over it, and they granted each other the choice of choosing one aspect of it than another. But the Africans had already begun to develop the main aspect that would go into their spiritual life.
An aspect that still goes into African spiritual life, if you visit the villages, you will not see it in the cities, but you will see it today in the villages. And that is bringing life in harmony with nature. And when we look at life today in the Western world is out of harmony with nature. It makes no sense. It makes no sense for one man to have enough bread to feed a multitude and to hold up the multitude. It makes no sense. There's a lack of balance. But Africans had a society where each man gave and each man had according to his needs. Now this was a form of social living that predates the concept of socialism. This is what Karl Marx misunderstood, and this is what the Marxists still misunderstood, and this is what they stupidly call primitive communism. It wasn't primitive at all. It was advanced, and it was Christian. Because they say religion is the opiate of the people, they can't deal with the fact that these early societies in that spirituality was a total thing. And religion wasn't the opiate of the people. Religion was part of the totality of the society and part of the day-by-day spirituality of the society, and it determined everything. It was only in the emptiness of Europe. It was only under feudalism. It was only in the misuse of the child. It was only in this regard, the hustlerism of the European church, that they turned it into the opiate of the people. But religion was never intended to be the opiate of the people. And this is why the European has no understanding of the non-European mind, of the non-European spirituality. These early religions were not hurriedly brought into being or hurriedly changed. They stayed in Paris for years. So the basic thing about these religions was to create balance in society, and a respect for the law of God. If you have a God, you have to have a God.
Yes.
here you had the first female deaconess. Here you had the first female gods of Israel. While Hathor is the best known of the early gods, because her influence spread to India, and the concept of the sacred cow started from the worship of Hathor. But the greatest and the most influential of all of the female gods is Maya, who is still worshipped. Now, Europe never had a female spiritual figure. At no time did any female rise to a permanent position in the spirituality of Europe or Islam. I'm saying that these Africans had created a society where the fear of the female mind was unknown, and where man was considered to be a balance or unbalanced without female companionship, and where sometimes the God was depicted as being a combination of male and female.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? I don't know if the Klan is in here tonight or not with all the trouble we're having with these microphones. Seldom, if ever, we're still working with it. As I was about to say, seldom, if ever, has such a diverse and truly ecumenical gathering convened under the aegis of politics in our nation. I want to commend the leadership of the National Conference on New Politics for all of the great work that they have done in making this significant convention possible. Indeed, by our very nature, we affirm that something new is taking place on the American political horizon. We have come here from the dusty plantations of the Deep South and the depressing ghettos of the North. We have come from the great universities and the flourishing suburbs. We have come from Appalachian poverty and from conscience-stricken wealth. But we have come. We have come here because we shared a common concern for the moral health of our nation. We have come because our eyes have seen through the superficial glory and glitter of our society and observed the coming of judgment, like the prophet of old. We have read the handwriting on the wall. We have seen our nation weighed in the balance of history and found wanting. We have come because we see this as a dark hour in the affairs of men. For most of us, this is a new mood. We are traditionally the idealists. We are the marchers from Mississippi and Selma and Washington, who staked our lives on the American dream during the first half of this decade. Many assemble here campaigned assiduously for Lyndon Johnson in 1964, because we could not stand idly by and watch our nation contaminated by the 18th century policies of Goldwaterism. We were the hardcore activists who were willing to believe that Southerners could be reconstructed in the constitutional image. We were the dreamers of a dream. That dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man would soon be transformed into bright tomorrows of justice. Now it is hard to escape the disillusionment of betrayal. Our hopes have been blasted and our dreams have been shattered. The promise of a great society was shipwrecked off the coast of Asia on the dreadful peninsula of Vietnam. The poor black and white, are still perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. What happens to a dream deferred? It leads to bewildering frustration and corroding bitterness. I came to see this in a personal experience here in Chicago last summer. And all the speaking that I have done in the United States before varied audiences, including some hostile whites, the only time that I have ever been booed was one night in our regular weekly mass meeting by some angry young men of our movement. I went home that night with an ugly feeling. Selfishly, I thought of my sufferings and sacrifices over the last 12 years. Why would they boo one so close to them? But as I lay awake thinking, I finally came to myself, and I could not for the life of me have less than patience and understanding for those young men. For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. This situation is all the more ominous in view of the rising expectations of men the world over. Deep rumblings that we hear today, rumbling of discontent, the thunder of disinherited masses, rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. All over the world, like a fever, freedom is spreading in the widest liberation movement in history. The great masses of people are determined to end the exploitation of their races and land. In one majestic chorus, they are singing in the words of our freedom song, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around." And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Millions, yes, billions, are appropriated for mass murder, but the most meager pittance of foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghetto, but the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program. The modest proposals for model cities, rent supplement, and rat control, pitiful as they were to begin with, get caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-Negro than anti-rat needs to be dismissed. It seems that our legislative assemblies have adopted Nero as their patron saint and are bent on fiddling while our cities burn. Even when the people persist and in the face of great obstacles develop indigenous leadership and self-help approaches to their problems, and finally tread the forest of bureaucracy to obtain existing government funds, the corrupt political order seeks to crush even this beginning of hope. The case of CDGM in Mississippi is the most publicized example, but it is a story repeated many times across our nation. Our own experience here in Chicago is especially painfully present. After an enthusiastic approval by HEW's Department of Adult Education, SCLC began an adult literacy project to aid 1,000 young men and women who have been pushed out of overcrowded ghetto schools in obtaining basically literacy skills prerequisite to receiving jobs. We had an agreement with A&P stores for 750 jobs through SCLC's job program, Operation Breadbasket, and had recruited over 500 pupils the first week. At that point, Congressman Kuczynski and the Daily Machine intervened and demanded that Washington cut off our funds or channel them through the machine control poverty program in Chicago. Now we have no problem with administrative supervision, but we do have a desire to be independent of machine control and the Democratic Party patronage network. For this desire for a politically independent approach to the needs of our brothers, our funds are being stopped as of September 15th, and a very meaningful program discontinued. Yes, the hour is dark. Evil comes forth in the guise of good. It is a time of double talk, when men in high places have a high blood pressure of deceptive rhetoric and an anemia of concrete performance. We crowd against welfare handouts to the poor, but generously approve an oil depletion allowance to make the rich richer. Six Mississippi plantations receive more than $1 million a year not to plant cotton, but no provision is made to feed the tenant farmer who is put out of work by the government subsidy. Crowning achievement in hypocrisy must go to those staunch Republicans and Democrats of the Midwest and West who were given land by our government when they came here as immigrants from Europe. They were given education through the land-grant colleges. They were provided with agriculture agents to keep them abreast of farming trends. They were granted low-interest loans to aid in the mechanization of their farm. And now that they have succeeded in becoming successful, they are paid not to farm. And these are the same people who now say to black people whose ancestors were brought to this country in chains and who were emancipated in 1863 without being given land to cultivate or bread to eat, that they must pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. What they truly advocate is socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I wish that I could say that this is just a passing phase in the cycle of our nation's life. Certainly times of war, times of reaction throughout the society. But I suspect that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness that has been lurking within our body politic from its very beginning. That is the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism. Not only is this our nation's dilemma, it is the plague of Western civilization. As early as 1906, W.E.B. Du Bois prophesied that the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. Now, as we stand two-thirds into this crucial period of history, we know full well that racism is still that hound of hell which dogs the tracks of our civilization. Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality on the question of race. She has been torn between selves, a self in which she proudly professed the great principles of democracy, and a self in which she madly practiced the antithesis of democracy. This tragic duality has produced a strange indecisiveness and ambivalence toward the Negro, causing America to take a step backward simultaneously with every step forward on the question of racial justice. Be at once attracted to the Negro and repelled by him, to love and to hate him. There has never been a solid, unified, and determined thrust to make justice a reality for Afro-Americans. The step backward has a new name today. It is called the white backlash. But the white backlash is nothing new. It is the surfacing of old prejudices, hostilities, and ambivalences that have always been there. It was caused neither by the cry of Black Power, nor by the unfortunate recent wave of riots in our cities. The white backlash of today is rooted in the same problem that has characterized America ever since the black man landed in chains on the shores of this nation. This does not imply that all white Americans are racist. Far from it. Many white people have, through a deep moral compulsion, fought long and hard for racial justice. Nor does it mean that America has made no progress in her attempt to cure the body politic of the disease of racism, or that the dogma of racism has not been considerably modified in recent years. However, for the good of America, it is necessary to refute the idea that the dominant ideology in our country, even today, is freedom and equality, while racism is just an occasional departure from the norm on the part of a few bigoted extremists. Racism can well be that corrosive evil that would bring down the curtain on Western civilization. Arnold Toynbee has said that some 26 civilizations have risen upon the face of the earth. Almost all of them have descended into the junk heaps of destruction. The decline and fall of these civilizations, according to Toynbee, not caused by external invasion, but by internal decay. They fail to respond creatively to the challenges impinging upon them. If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men. The second aspect of our afflicted society is extreme materialism. An Asian writer has portrayed our dilemma in candid terms. He says, "You call your thousand material devices labor-saving machinery, yet you are forever busy with the multiplying of your old machinery. You grow increasingly fatigued, anxious, nervous, dissatisfied. Whatever you have, you want more. Wherever you are, you want to go somewhere else. Your devices are neither time-saving nor soul-saving machinery. There are so many sharp spurs which urge you on to invent more machinery and to do more business. This tells us something about our civilization that cannot be cast aside as a prejudiced charge by an Eastern thinker who is jealous of Western prosperity. We cannot escape the indictment. This does not mean that we must turn back the clock of scientific progress. No one can overlook the wonders that science has wrought for our lives. The automobile will not abdicate in favor of the horse and buggy, of the train in favor of the stagecoach, of the tractor in favor of the hand plow, of the scientific method in favor of ignorance and superstition. But our moral lag must be redeemed when scientific power outruns moral power. We end up with guided missiles and misguided men. When we foolishly maximize the minimum and minimize the maximum, we sign the warrant for our own day of doom. It is this moral lag in our thing-oriented society that blinds us to the human realities around us, purges us, and the greed and exploitation creates the sector of poverty in the midst of wealth. Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves. And continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. Negroes and poor whites do not participate in the free flow of wealth within our economy. They will forever be poor, giving their energy, their talents, and their limited funds to the consumer market, but reaping few benefits and services in return. The way to end poverty is to end the exploitation of the poor, ensure them a fair share of the government services and the nation's resources. I proposed recently that a national agency be established to provide employment for everyone needing it. Nothing is more socially inexcusable than unemployment in this age. In the 30s, when the nation was bankrupt, it instituted such an agency, the WPA. In the present conditions of a nation glutted with resources, it is barbarous to condemn people desiring work to soul-sapping inactivity and poverty. I am convinced that even this one massive act of concern would do more than all the state police and armies of the nation to quell riots and steal hatreds. The tragedy is that our materialistic culture does not possess the statesmanship necessary to do it. Victor Hugo could have been thinking of 20th century America when he wrote, "There's always more misery among the lower classes than there is humanity in the higher classes." Time has come for America to face the inevitable choice between materialism and humanism. We must devote at least as much to our children's education and the health of the poor as we do to the care of our automobiles and the building of beautiful, impressive hotels. We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power. We must further recognize that the ghetto is a domestic colony. Black people must develop programs that will aid in the transfer of power and wealth into the hands of residents of the ghetto so that they may, in reality, control their own destiny. This is the meaning of new politics. People of goodwill in the larger community must support the black man in this effort. The final phase of our national sickness is the disease of militarism. Nothing more clearly demonstrates our nation's abuse of military power than our tragic adventure in Vietnam. This war has played havoc with the destiny of the entire world. It's torn up the Geneva Agreement. It seriously impaired the United Nations. It has exacerbated the hatred between continents and, worse still, between races. It has frustrated our development of home at home, telling our own underprivileged citizens that we place insatiable military demands above their most critical needs. It greatly contributed to the forces of reaction in America and strengthened the military-industrial complex. And it has practically destroyed Vietnam and left thousands of American and Vietnamese youth maimed and mutilated, and expose the whole world to the risk of nuclear warfare. Above all, the The war in Vietnam has revealed what Senator Fulbright calls our nation's arrogance of power. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for the war in Vietnam. And many of these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against the fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. No war in our nation's history has ever been so violative of our conscience, our national interests, and so destructive of our moral standing before the world. No enemy has ever been able to cause such damage to us as we inflict upon ourselves. The inexorable decay of our urban centers has flared into terrifying domestic conflict as the pursuit of foreign war absorbs our wealth and energy. Squalor and poverty scar our cities as our military might destroys cities in a far-off land to support oligarchy to intervene in domestic conflict. The president who cherishes consensus for peace has intensified the war. In answer to a cry to stop the war, it has brought tauntingly to 1 minute flying time from China to a moment before the midnight of world conflagration. We are offered a tax for war instead of a plan for peace. Men of reason should no longer debate the merits of war or means of financing war. They should end the war and restore sanity and humanity to American policy. If the will of the people continues to be unheeded, all men of goodwill must create a situation in which the 1967-68 elections are made a referendum on the war. The American people must have an opportunity to vote into oblivion those who cannot detach themselves from militarism.
Tonight, as Dr. King was talking, we're getting ready to go into our other part of our service from 10:30 to 11. As I ask you to set up and get ready for a breakthrough, get ready for something that happened for you. Last night we had people that let God talk to them. And a couple of people called me and told me that they had got a message, not from Bishop. They got a message from God. God talked to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God can talk to you. I want to tell you tonight, get ready for a message from God. Sit down somewhere where you can meditate, where you get quiet, and listen to God talk to you. You're going to talk to, you know. And some people say God don't talk to you. Get by yourself.
And there might have been people around you, but nobody that you could talk to. Has there ever been a time like when everybody in the house was asleep? And because of the need in your life, you found yourself talking to God. As you know, there's one tender the thought that God don't hear you and God don't talk back. But I know that's not right. I talked to him this morning. And sometimes, you have to be still and know. Hello, anybody here feel like talking back to me? Sometimes, mama's there, father's there, husband, wife is there, children around, but you can't talk to them. Because they don't understand the situation. You can't talk to friends because they need well, but they just have a gossiping nature. Before you can hang up, your good friend calls you good friend. And his good friend calls his other friend that. But it gets back to you, the crush. Sometimes you just have to deal with God in the stillness of your life. We sing a song here in the temple that says, "Any way you bless me, Lord." And sometimes you just have to ask God, Lord,
folks, old folks used to say that, they said, let me check with God. You be looking for somebody, and they'll pray about it. Somebody know what I'm talking about. Tonight, I want you to get ready for God to talk to you personally. You can tell somebody, God talked to me. Bishop didn't talk to me. The Pope didn't talk to me. My elders. God's going to talk directly to you tonight. You have to listen to what God said to you because God's going to talk personally to you tonight. And like people say, well, God don't talk to you. He talked to Abraham. He talked to Isaac. He talked to David. He can talk to you. Clean up your temple. Get your mind together where God can talk to you. Where you heard it from, I heard it directly from God. They're going to look at you funny. When God says, stop drinking, stop smoking, stop the dope, stop lying, stop being cheap with yourself. God's going to tell you all that. Oh, Bishop told me, no, I didn't tell you that. God said it. I'm taking this time from 10:30 to 11. Brother James Cleveland get through. I want you to sit back, get your chair, get your coffee, get to where you can be quiet, where God can talk to you.
Before you can hang up, your good friend calls your good friend. And his good friend calls his other friend. But it gets back to you first. Sometimes you just have to do it in the
stillness of your life. We sing a song here in the temple that says, any way you bless me, Lord, I'll be satisfied. And sometimes you just have to ask God, Lord, let it breathe over me. I'll be all right if you get the breath of the Lord. So just breathe. I'm like the writer that says, you don't have to make no special trip to bless me. But while you're next door blessing my name,
glory,
do not
pass me by.
Pass me by.
Breathe on me. God's going to talk to you quick, fast, and in a hurry.
This is my choice. Everybody's had a song. I reach way back. Way back. Young folk won't know it, but some of the older people might remember the word. Just simply says, we
get ready. I want God to talk to you tonight, Francis. Lord, I want God to talk to you about your situation. Whatever you're going through tonight, for 30 minutes, get your pens and paper, because you might forget what God told you. He might have told you to stop. He might have told you your finances are on his way. He might tell you that you heal. But God going to talk to you tonight. I hope you're able to listen. Get the evil out of your heart. Clean your temper up. Yes, 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 tonight. Let God listen to what God's saying to you. He's not talking to your mama, your sister, he's talking to you. And who all listen tonight, God's going to speak to you. Get your mind ready. Clear your mind. Take everything out of your mind. Sit back. And listen to what God said to you about any situation. He's going to do it. But you got to clear your mind up for him to do it. Once you clear your mind up, God's going to do it quick, fast. For you that going through the night, I'm praying for you tonight. Let me pray quickly, Father God, take them to another level. Just breathe on me. Give him a word. This is out for you, Francis. Mother Francis, New Orleans, for you. Mother Rosie Cook, for you. Emma, this for you in Romulus. This for you, Sister Rose, this for you. Mary Hawkins for you. Pearl, this for you. Pearl Williams, this for you.
They are.
Get ready. Get ready for God to talk to you tonight. I want somebody to say, call me, said one lady called me last night and said, God told me some stuff, and just like God told me. And she called somebody and said, I talked to God. Are you crazy? I'm crazy enough to know God can talk to you. Get ready for God to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. 'Cause if you let him run, he won't.